Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. President Lyndon Johnson needed 72 pens to sign the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In contrast, President Obama used 22 pens to sign his landmark legislation, the Affordable Care Act. Some presidents will give pens as historic souvenirs to individuals who helped pass and shepherd legislation. And LBJ's Civil Rights Act signing used the most pens of any president. And there's a reason for that. He needed a lot of help to get that historic act passed. Here's President Johnson talking about the need for the Civil Rights Act.
Our generation of Americans has been called on to continue the unending search for justice within our own borders. We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment. We believe that all men have certain unalienable rights, yet many Americans do not enjoy those rights. We believe that all men are entitled to the blessings of liberty, yet millions are being deprived of those blessings, not because of their own failures, but because of the color of their skin. The reasons are deeply embedded in history and tradition and the nature of man. We can understand without rancor or hatred how this all happened, but it cannot continue. Our Constitution, the foundation of our republic, forbids it. The principles of our freedom forbid it. Morality forbids it. And the law I will sign tonight forbids it.
And this year marks the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That act, along with the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the Fair Housing Act of 1968, transformed the nation. We will be talking about the effort to pass the Civil Rights Act and what that act means to you today. And we do want to hear from you. What does the Civil Rights Act mean to you? What do you think America would look like if LBJ and the Reverend Martin Luther King had come up short and didn't get the passage through? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org or write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. Our guest this half hour, Clay Risen, has written the book, The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. Risen is a staff editor at the New York Times Op-Ed and Sunday Review section. His first book, A Nation on Fire, America in the Wake of the King Assassination. And our other guest, Todd Purdom, he is the author of An Idea Whose Time Has Come, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and the Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Purdom is a senior writer at Politico and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He was formerly with the New York Times where he worked there for 23 years. Welcome both of y'all to The Source.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
Let me ask both of you and Clay, if you could go first, who are some of these unsung heroes of the Civil Rights Act?
Well, you have a whole range of people inside government and in kind of the movement around it. Inside the government, you have guys like Bill McCulloch, who is the ranking Republican member of the Judiciary Committee and really helped push a bill push the bill forward among a section of the legislative body, the conservative Republicans, who might not have otherwise gone along with it. And you also have guys like Clarence Mitchell, who was the NAACP's lead lobbyist and really helped bring the force of the movement writ large, the civil rights movement, to bear in Washington in a way that made politicians respond.
And Todd, who would you name as some of the great unsung heroes of the passage of the Civil Rights Act?
Well, the very ones Clay named, along with an incredible grassroots coalition of interfaith groups led by the National Council of Churches and the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights and their allies, who had a very strategic idea that since President Kennedy himself had described this bill as primarily a moral issue, as old as the scriptures and as clear as the American Constitution, they made it a point of targeting their efforts on senators and congressmen from the Midwest and Great Plains states who didn't have large black constituencies and might not have had any natural reason to support civil rights, but who had a lot of Methodists and Presbyterians and Baptists and Catholics and would be susceptible to a moral appeal from their pulpits. And in fact, it was that lobbying effort from the outside that did what President Obama so often has said: you can't change Washington from Washington, you have to change it from out in the country, and that's exactly what happened in 1963 and 64.
And Todd, so your book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come, So the stage had been set in the nation for this momentous occasion, this fight. Do you think things like, you know, the movie To Kill a Mockingbird had been out like for a year, and it seemed like there were things in the zeitgeist of the country saying we need to address this?
It's absolutely true. The culture had been changing, and there was a generation of younger legislators who'd grown up in the Depression, fought in World War II, come back together. African Americans themselves who'd been in the service and been in France or Europe and did not experience Jim Crow, it was hard to ask them to come home and go back to the same old ways they'd lived with before. And, of course, from the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, the Supreme Court Brown decision in 1954, for really almost 10 years, a great deal of pressure and change had been coming to bear in the country on this question of civil rights. And 100 years after the Civil War had ended, it really fell to President Kennedy and then President Johnson to take the next logical step.
Clay, your book, The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act, the battle against who? Who was fighting against the Civil Rights Act?
Well, the primary opposition came from Southern Democrats, both in the House and the Senate, who had spent decades, I mean, really since the end of Reconstruction, building a giant wall, both in the South that separated black from white, but also in Washington that prevented any kind of legislation from moving to promote the interests or protect the rights of African Americans, even things that might seem tangential or indirect, like New Deal legislation to give more benefits to African Americans. That was considered a foot in the door that might open the possibility for federal efforts to cut down Jim Crow. So that was really up until the very end. I mean, these were the people who were leading the filibuster. This was the big challenge for the supporters of the Civil Rights Act to overcome.
So when we talk about Southern Democrats being involved in the fight against, and of course they had a historic filibuster led by Senator Byrd against that, 1964. So when we talk about party labels in this battle, I mean, do party labels really apply? Is it more just about regionalism, Clay?
Well, at the time, there was certainly a lot more ideological fluidity between the two parties. So you had Republicans who were more liberal than most Democrats are today, I would say. You also had the Southern Democratic Coalition that had a number of, some people who were populists who supported the New Deal in certain senses, but were very conservative on anything that touched on race. And after the bill, and partly, I'd say, in large part because of the bill and other civil rights legislation, you started to see a realignment where the South became more Republican, and of course other parts of the country realigned as well in response.
Sure, that's the Southern strategy of Richard Nixon trying to take advantage of the resentment after the Civil Rights Act's passage of 1964. But Todd, with the two parties involved in the battle, I mean, there were certainly Republicans who were definitely in favor of the passage of the Civil Rights Act.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, the leader of the effort in the Senate eventually was the Republican minority leader, Everett Dirksen of Illinois, who was a marvelous, colorful character, a kind of showboating figure we don't see in Congress too much anymore, but also a meticulous legislative draftsman with a crackerjack legal staff. And he was from Illinois, the land of Lincoln. He took seriously his party's role in that regard. And his objection was basically that he did not want – his state already had strong anti-discrimination laws on the books and a tradition of enforcing them. And he did not want, as he saw it, the typical small Midwestern businessman to be harassed by a duplicate set of federal regulations on particularly employment discrimination. So the compromise that he worked out, along with dozens of changes in sort of language that didn't mean much substantively – he basically argued that the states with these laws should have the first crack at enforcing them before the Fed stepped in. And this had the effect of bringing along a lot of fellow conservatives from the Midwest to support cutting off debate. And it also had the effect of making the law apply overwhelmingly to the South, which the Southerners realized, and leaving in place the de facto segregation in the North. And I'm calling you from Boston right now, and certainly there's no city in America that had more searing late 20th century experience with segregation than Boston.
Right, the busing issues.
Exactly.
So we're talking about the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It was this 50 years ago this week, this year, and this week they will be marking the occasion at the LBJ Library. Presidents, all of them who are with us except for George Herbert Walker Bush, because of his ill condition, he won't be able to attend. But that's going to be quite an event. So let me ask you, Clay, when you talk about the battle to pass this Civil Rights Act, there was another Civil Rights Act in 1957, which was primarily concerned with voting rights. What did both sides learn in that battle that came to the fore in 64?
Well, I think one thing is, it opened the door for the idea of civil rights legislation that made possible the idea that Congress could actually, nothing like that had ever passed in any form, even the most meager civil rights legislation. And so here was something largely the product of Lyndon Johnson's political mastery. It wasn't a particularly strong bill. It was whittled down significantly from the way that it was introduced. But it was nevertheless a bill that could survive, and it showed the possibility. At the same time, I think a lot of Southerners who had backed away and allowed the bill to pass in the hopes that it might sort of, diffuse the possibility of further legislation, nevertheless saw that bill pass and saw another bill in 1960, and now they were confronted with an even bigger bill in 64. And I think partly for that reason they said, we will not compromise anymore. We are just going to put our foot down, oppose this bill to the very end, and hope that the other side gives up before we do.
And Strom Thurmond did filibuster the Civil Rights Bill of 1957, 24 hours and 13 minutes, I think, on that filibuster.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which, of course, put LBJ in the White House. He was, you talk about two presidents, Todd, in your book, putting their stamp on this. How did his assassination, his martyrdom, influence the final outcome of the Civil Rights Bill, Todd?
Well, it clearly had a galvanizing effect. The national grief and guilt that followed President Kennedy's assassination gave President Johnson a perfect excuse to say that no memorial could be more fitting than this bill for which he fought so long and so hard. The truth is, President Kennedy himself, in the fall of 1963, had been executed some pretty adroit legislative craftsmanship in getting the bill out of the House Judiciary Committee and rescuing it from the most ardent supporters of civil rights and the biggest liberals in Congress, who would have filled it up with so many provisions that it might eventually have failed in the whole House, if not certainly in the Senate. And so while President Kennedy typically does not get much credit as being an expert legislator, and President Johnson, if anything, gets a little bit too much credit for bringing all his skill to bear on the bill, I think that the bill was, in fact, had passed a very dangerous point by the time of the president's assassination. And so the challenge for President Johnson was to keep everybody's eye on the prize and just press forward as hard and as fast as he could.
So, Clay, the Bill of the Century is your book, Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. Was this really about African-Americans, the black population versus the white establishment? Where was the concerns for what's going to happen to our Latinos and Hispanic population in Texas or in the nation?
Well, ethnicity and national origin were included in the bill, and so they were, somewhat, covered to some extent. It wasn't really an issue at the time. I would say that a lot of the activism around...
It wasn't an issue if you didn't live in South Texas, I guess.
No, I'm sorry. It certainly wasn't an issue in the debate over the bill. It certainly wasn't an issue in the country. But I think it was because of legislation like this that gave more exposure and more attention on issues relating to civil rights beyond simply what was, the focus of the bill, which was really on the Jim Crow South.
Right, and the Jim Crow laws, those were actual laws. They were enshrined in the state laws, and they had a law in Texas where you couldn't have a socializing, mixing of the races and things. So did it really require a federal law to sort of strike down those Jim Crow laws? Or some people suspect that if we never had passed a Civil Rights Act, that they would eventually have fallen away, that we didn't actually need a Civil Rights Act of 1964, Todd?
Oh, I think you needed it. I think they would have fallen away. But the question in the title of my book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come, I mean, arguably the idea was a century old. The Civil War was supposed to have got at this problem. And that title comes from something Senator Dirksen said, paraphrasing Victor Hugo, stronger than all the armies is an idea whose time has come. And the truth was that by 1964, as we discussed earlier in the program, how the culture was changing and the zeitgeist was changing, I don't think the country could have waited too much longer to get this law on the books. Now, you're right that it did cause a backlash effect in certain places. And I do think you're also right that the moral tide was such that segregation would have petered out over time. But we see, as I said earlier, how durable segregation remains in places where it's not even illegal. So, where it's not even legal, where segregation is not legally enforced. It happens by sort of, you know, happenstance and practice. And I think that I think that we needed this law.
And Clay, you talk about the epic battle for the Civil Rights Act, and you know there's so much focus on the political power of LBJ and the inspirational power of Dr. Martin Luther King. So do you think that there's too much focus on those two individuals? And so in the narrative, as we talk about how to get big things done, we forget about the little heroes who do go to the sit-ins and marches and make a big difference.
I think that's right. I mean, of course, the two of them played enormous roles in the bill, and I don't think that it's wrong to credit them with that. But at the same time, it's important to understand, you know, not only the context in which all this was happening, but also the way in which the context, the movements, the people in the streets, the little guys, as you said, but also, you know, people in the Justice Department, the various staff members in the House and Senate, who really played an important, if unsung, role in crafting this bill and pushing it forward, that we have to understand them not only to get the history right and to to give them their due, but also to better understand the way that these sorts of things happen.
And right after the passage and signing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, there was a constitutional challenge to it, Todd. And how did that go? And do you think we would have had a different result today?
One was from a motel in Atlanta about the public accommodation section, the part that desegregated hotels and the like. And by December of that year, by December of 1964, the Supreme Court had upheld that provision. And partly because the law had passed with such overwhelming bipartisan support, it passed the Senate 73-27, it really was mostly swiftly and broadly accepted, in contrast to the Affordable Care Act, which President Obama was forced to pass on such a narrow partisan basis. And he's paid a price for that in terms of the continued opposition to it around the country and the way that it's remained a political football in a way that the Civil Rights Act really did not.
So today we're celebrating 50 years after the passage and the signing this year. It was 1964. So do you think that our younger generations have not really an idea of what was accomplished, Todd?
Well, certainly, I know Clay has young children, too, but in my own case, my 10-year-old son and 14-year-old daughter, I don't think they really can possibly really imagine what the situation was like 50 years ago before this law passed. At the same time, I think it should be said that, you know, the journey is not over and the job is not done. And on the night he proposed the bill in 1963, President Kennedy cited a series of very sobering statistics about the differential prospects of a black and white baby born on the same day in the same city. And on questions like access to education and life expectancy and general health and welfare, things are much better today for black children. But on the questions of lifetime earning power and income and things like that, they're distressingly the same.
And Clay, what do you think about the younger generation and their knowledge of the Civil Rights Act?
Oh, I think it's very it's pretty thin. I mean, I grew up in Nashville in the 80s, and this was a place that had been desegregated largely because of the civil rights movement and because of laws like the Civil Rights Act. And I was it was simply not part of my education in any way, either in schools or kind of in the public at large. And I think that really reflects a general experience that there's a, you know, unfortunately, with progress comes a sort of forgetting of where that came from, and we're often willing to say, well, we had the Civil Rights Act and that's done, and now we can move on to other things, and we forget about not only how the bill came about but also what the bill meant and why it continues to be important. And so Yeah, I think that young people today, if they're sort of following the path that that my education took, they are probably unfortunately very unaware of this history.
Yeah, the Civil Rights Act wasn't the first Civil Rights Act, and it wasn't the last. So who knows if there's more in our future? Thank
sure.
both of you for joining us, Todd Purdom. He is the author of An Idea Whose Idea Has Come: Two Parties, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and the Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Clay Risen, The Bill of the Century: The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. Great books, great topics. Thank you both for being on The Source today.
Thanks for having us.
And this is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.